Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Shipping Excellence Podcast. I have with me here today Chris Janes, who is a former VP of product at Red Ventures, turned fractional CTO, who himself has explained it as figuring out what he wants to do when he grows up. I'm excited to have him here. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Chris has started his fractional CTO business, and we're all at the end of year crunch right now and working through deliverables, but he has some really exciting things to talk to us about today. Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. I kind of use it as a joke, but also not really. There's this great book, Range, by David Epstein, and he sort of talks about having a lot of experiences builds better sort of innovation and ideas. You know, teams that don't have just one specific thing are the ones who come up with new innovative stuff. And so I always describe my past kind of CV resume as eclectic, which means I've dabbled in a lot of things. I've been in a lot of different startups and businesses. My background's computer science, and then I dabbled in film for grad school. And so I'm a very curious person, which kind of leads into the figuring out what I want to do with a bunch of the skills I've had. So I know you and I've talked a good bit about what does it mean to consult? What does it mean to be a fractional sort of person to help companies get started? And so what I'm excited about, and I know you and I've talked about this a few times, is just the ability to find new problems with people and only focus on the problems. You know, the cool thing about being at a large company is you get to do a lot of things that usually as you get higher up morphs into people problems and processes and how are we delivering and expectations. You don't kind of get to do the fun stuff, which is the experimenting with new code. You know, there's new stuff coming out every day that I can't keep up with now that I'm even focusing on it. But it's fun to kind of get back to experimenting with what's possible and see how do you bring those solutions to people that don't have time to do that.
Yeah, that is exciting. Speaking of some of the fun stuff, I woke up last night, I was working and was trying to mess around with ChatGPT and it went down. I'm excited again because like that's the new toy that we get to play with. But I agree, like, you know, when you're higher up in the company, as you move up to solve people problems instead of technical problems, you get further and further away, you know, removed from hands-on. So I'm curious to talk a little bit about, you know, how you focus on problems and what to work on when you're within a big company as you're moving further away from the technical.
Yeah, it's a lot of, I wish there was here's a good algorithm or heuristic to go through and say, like, this is the most important thing for us to do. But one of the good things with tenure at a company or at least domain expertise as you go through it is you kind of start getting a sense for, I've seen this pattern play out, or I would always kind of describe it as you see a bunch of dots starting to connect. People would kind of comment of, I'd have this kind of confused look on my face as we were working through trying define what problems to work on of, you know, it's almost like trying to compute the, okay, if we put all these things together, we're actually solving this and opening up this other opportunity. So it just comes with a lot of kind of processing a lot of information, being able to calibrate, you know, what's our larger goal as an organization, what's our larger goal as a team, and then how do you turn that into some sort of deliverable, which was I've always kind of gravitated to product, which is that kind of, you know, people describe it as you're describing the what and why, but you're really trying to build that puzzle. Or, you know, I mentioned my grad school degree was in film and I never wanted to be a director because those guys, you know, film directors are crazy. You kind of have to be to have that sort of artistic vision and sort of drive to do stuff. But it's a very similar problem where you have this either script or notion of what it has to do. And then you have to bring a bunch of people together to say, I'm going to deliver this movie. You know, Christopher Nolan and all his movies, I'm sure he spends a lot of time researching and coming in on the, how do I want to talk about Inception, or how do I want to, you know, film this? And that sort of creative part can be applied to technology, can be applied to a bunch of different ways to say, great, we've taken in all the script, we've taken all the materials, we have a lot of creative feedback from designers, we have all the things that translates into this either product or technology or feature. Then you get to go build it. And we get into kind of a product management philosophy in a minute. But that kind of upfront work is where I find a lot of excitement of, okay, you know, you're describing a problem you have or you think you have. And if you dig around that enough, it can turn into either a tangential problem or your problem even is just like the tip of the iceberg, right? And you have to get into, well, actually, you really want to get down to there's something else we can solve, which unlocks all this other stuff that you didn't know was causing that problem. And spending a lot of time there is where you get to bring in, like, what is the cutting edge tech? Like, how do we use ChatGPT? How do we, you know, use the latest feature in Excel, if we're being very kind of simplistic about something too? But I don't know, you get to connect a lot of dots if I kind of come back to a final answer there.
Yeah. We were just talking about, before we hit record today, about why do podcasts. And, you know, pre-COVID, we all went to the office. It was a pretty standard process. And my routine was, you know, make a cup of coffee, go talk to people, kind of, you know, get ready for the day. And, you know, lunch, same thing, go to the, you know, have lunch with different people at the office. And we don't really have that as much anymore, as a lot of the world has gone remote or hybrid. And, you know, it's, I think when you have that opportunity to let your mind wander and have conversations for fun, and you're exploring, you know, you're just exploring the ideas that are roaming around in your head, it's a sort of a discovery. You get to discover different pieces of the problems and puzzles that, you know, that you're working or solving. And then, you know, you find both creative solutions to the things that you're solving, but also, like you said, tangentially related problems that may be the linchpin in the main problem you're trying to solve, or that are also incredibly important to solve when you're building products, right? To bring better customer experiences to people. So I'm curious though. So tell me a little bit about, you know, your product management philosophy, because you kind of dropped that just now, and I'm curious about that.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't. So product is really hard to define for a lot of people. And it's one of those kind of classic job roles it's very amorphous. I think the best example I've heard of it described is, you know, product management's kind of like water. It takes the shape of the organization. You know, at someone more established now with Google, it's a very different practice than an early stage startup where it's a product-led founder. You know, there's just different tasks and responsibilities and sort of metrics you're organizing against. But over the years, because this question comes up a lot, so either people are asking you like, hey, I'm starting product management and I'm curious what it is, or you're in an annual review and you're trying to justify what you did for a year and explaining to someone who's not a product manager what you do on a day-to-day basis, which can look very differently. And so I steal this from sort of the Spotify software delivery model, if you're familiar with that. They're kind of agile, always sort of delivery, but it's the idea of the four shuns: ideation, definition, creation, validation. And so those are the kind of key, what I'll call product development milestones, where product works very differently across what's sort of happening. You know, in ideation, that was what I was just sort of alluding to, which is the fun, like, I'm staying on top of the latest technology, I'm trying to figure out what patterns you can solve with those, or I'm meeting with a bunch of people, whether that's coffee or podcast. Also, this is my first podcast. I would love to go back and look at my Spotify, how many hours of podcasts I've listened to now, however long this is, like, just that, what that ratio is. But I'll come back with that answer.
Yeah, let me know when you get that. I'll add it to the show notes. It'd be interesting.
But in that ideation phase, you know, you're doing a lot of kind of what's exciting, which is exploring, problem solving, just learning and trying to come up with what ultimately is the, okay, what do we need to go then define? And so that definition phase, that's when you're really being ruthless in the, well, look, we wanted to build the best AI product that was going to solve everything, but A, we don't have time or money. So you have to get kind of ruthless in the, okay, what's the scope of it? How are we going to judge success on this? What are the sort of resources we need? You know, you sort of get more granular on what that is. And then I always talk about the ideation, definition, creation. Creation's where, you know, if you're building a digital product, you're working with engineering, designers, all that good stuff. I don't mean to trivialize that work, but if you've done those two steps further up, that part's kind of the easy part. You know, it's, you have a very clear, like, definition and scope of what you want to do. There's obviously collaboration with that team, but building something isn't necessarily hard. Building the right thing and defining what that is harder. And then most people think once you're done with building it, you're done. We did it. Congratulations. We've launched. But that's when, you know, that validation stage that everyone really forgets about, which is, okay, are people using it? First of all, are they using it effectively? All those sort of success metrics we set up further up, are people even, like, coming close to what we thought was possible? But the great news, and this is where it comes from, that Spotify kind of reinforcement sort of process, is all that starts back to in the ideation phase of, great, you know, the KPI we're going for wasn't being hit. That's not necessarily a failure. That's just now a signal point from your users telling you you misread what they wanted or did. And then you kind of get to start that process over again too. So, you know, with product, you get to do all those fun things. And I think, to kind of jump around a little bit, that creation phase is always where I find a lot of energy from the, okay, but, like, what did we build with? Like, how are we using the most cutting edge tech? It's almost like you get to set up people to go have fun and explore and do that. You don't get to do that, which kind of brought me back to the, and I really want to get more hands-on with some of that stuff too. But yeah, that's my larger product philosophy of like how you just move things from conception to deliverables and then keep iterating on it.
You know, coming up as an engineer myself, which is what I wanted to be when I grew up, it's the iterative process is something that we're like, well versed in. We've been doing agile for decades now. And I have found, again, like the one of the most important, the most fun process is the creation. I agree with you. And I think that's why we find a lot of energy there. But I think one of the most important aspects of the process when you're building products is the validation phase. Because to your point, when you release, what you've been creating over the past however long, 3, 6, 9, 12 months, and you get feedback from the market whether or not it's valuable. To your point, it's not the end. It is the, if you think about iteration as this circular process, right? There's an outer ring that is the larger iteration process of building products, and that is the four shuns that you've described here. And so when you get that piece of validation of, well, maybe it is exceptional and we're all going to be founders of unicorns and we're all happy, right? But when it's not, you get that feedback, you have to continue iterating on the, what I like to call the outer ring of the iteration process. And so I love the creation phase too, but after launching many products across my career, I've begun to love the validation phase because that's really where you find out what you've made, if it's valuable, and what you can do to make it more valuable in the future. Oftentimes, you can find tangentially related problems to the core problem that your software is solving for your clients. And so you can deepen your relationship and the value that you provide to your existing clients by focusing on the feedback that they provide for you. And then you could also look at clients that are just outside of your target client base. Because maybe your product doesn't have a piece of functionality that they need. That's another piece of feedback that you can take to iterate on the next iteration of your product.
I am getting something to consumers or users who are not people you normally use sooner rather than later is the best thing you can do in your development process. And I don't know where this comes from. I'm curious, we can kind of debate this from the product and technical side. It's almost I've seen a lot of engineers in the past, and especially like previous startup phase, where it's really hard and they get very nervous because they've not had a protective environment where, oh, you release something, right? We have to blame, and if it takes down production, like there's a whole sort of process, even though there's like a culture of, well, there's blameless retros and things like that too. But there's a little bit more trepidation to put something out there that's an ugly baby, right? It's that like, well, it's not perfect. You're like, I know, but look back at the history of like what Facebook looked like to start, what Google, Amazon, all those first versions looking back now are just horrendous. But what do? They got it out there, they got feedback from people using it, and then they kept iterating to solve the things they didn't. If we're building, I've always struggled in the past when it comes to product vision. Like, this is a very kind of big word that has a lot of baggage with it. But if you're building something that is just purely for you, I think you're building the wrong thing. You have to be thinking about who that end consumer is, what the market I'm changing is. There should be something outside that's driving that then you can go validate against. And the sooner you get that feedback from what that is, then you really know what you're doing. And I've never been so lucky to release the first thing that solved all those things. And it becomes more about not what you put out there, but how you react to the feedback that you put out there. And that's where I think a lot of the successful unicorns we've seen over time are just really good at taking that, like, oh, it's not personal. It's just what people want, and I'm trying to solve what that is. So the more I get signals or feedback or user stories or just anecdote or dog food, because I'm using it myself, you just understand what you need to solve more and more and more. So the more people get involved in that validation phase, there's no, I've heard a lot of people say recently, like pride of ownership, or there's no kind of, you should follow the shot all the way through, because again, that's like the most important feedback you're going to get. And so if you're not an engineer knocking on doors, being like, hey, how'd the release go? Or, the thing's working. Or if you're a product person just says, oh, it's out there, like I'll check users, in 2 weeks or so. Oh, you're just missing so much valuable insight.
Agreed. You know, one of my biggest peeves is building software that people don't use. Yeah, this happens so many times.
I forget which podcast or book I read this in, but it's someone has the phrase, it's like, life is just too short for shitty software. Like think how much time you're wasting of people, or what or what software we were joking about, a piece of software that will go unnamed before this that had some UI problems that if you use this, you might know what that is. So it's just, why would you put that out there knowing people are struggling with it or not listening to that sort of signal? Have you heard of fullstory.com? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have heard of it, yes.
Fullstory is a great product. They've morphed into a lot of different things, but I love that idea that they started early on with is like watching product game film. And I think I was probably one of the first group of startups using that. I got connected through a friend to the founder. And it was just a fun thing to go through and say, hey, let's look at people struggling with this. And you should really lean into that pain of like, they just don't know where to click or they keep moving around. Or the best product branding anyone has ever done is Fullstory's Rage Click, which is like, find me all the scenarios where someone's just like, ah, why is this not working? And then just going and seeing that. It's just, again, it's so cool to sit over someone's shoulders and get, again, pure, unadulterated feedback of what you tried to put out there. And then you quickly realize like, oh, I misread everything. And you need to be very humble about that because great. Like you're not going to tell every person that rage click, sorry, you're doing it wrong. Like clearly it was you.
Yeah, agreed. I had a conversation one time with a guy I worked with and his entire philosophy was, well, the software works, it's the user's fault. And I said, that's the wrong way to approach that. You want the users to use the software, right? So yeah. You make it intuitive. And so, yeah, I completely disagreed with that point of view. And I like, you know, Fullstory is awesome because you can get to find out where the problems are with your software by people just using it. So, you know, going back to like, no one wants to be told that their baby's ugly and using Facebook as the example, there's a really interesting episode on the Acquired podcast about Meta.
I've been working through it. I think I'm 5 of the 6 hours into it at this point.
It's so long. But it's so good. Yeah, it's so good. You know, like a more recent technology is ChatGPT that released in 2022. And if you compare what is capable of today, the applications that have been built on top of it, and all of the LLMs today, the high-powered modern ones, compared to what they are today, you can see the evolution of a product. It was good enough to release, but it certainly had nowhere near the capability that it has today. Yeah. And so one of the things that I'm curious about is, how do you see the application of these LLM technologies as they relate to legacy systems?
Yeah. So very powerful from a ability to understand nuances about very legacy systems. And so there's this great book, Kill It With Fire. I think the author's name is Mariana Belotti. I'm sorry, I probably butchered that last name. But she went through her sort of focus of her startup or her sort of consulting was finding banks with legacy COBOL systems and very antiquated sort of ideas of like, I've got to come in, I've got to understand decisions that were made and then understand ways to remediate it, knowing I cannot change everything. Like, how do you work within it? And so I have been very fortunate in the past couple months to find a smattering of clients and some of them in very antiquated manufacturing sort of industries that, you know, they're doing very well at what they do. They can produce the things, but they didn't keep up with technology the same way we did. And so there's just a lot of processes and third-party applications that are legitimately from the 90s that aren't supported, but are mission critical. And being able to have something that can feed a document of either old documentation or even point me to, hey, there's this Actian PSQL that's not Postgres. What is that? Who did it? And how do I understand how to work around that? Like, what's the underlying file structure? It's not a relational DB. It's a bunch of, you know, flattened files that have proprietary data in it that it's sort of zipping up on the fly. And so I see these LLMs as being able to bring knowledge with domain specific, either information you're adding to it or documentation to help you understand, okay, what's possible here? And so, you know, as we talked about a little bit about the ChatGPT-6, you know, it's really good at telling you things and making you feel good about it. But what I'm actually really interested in those prompts, I can't remember if we've talked about this in the past, but almost adversarial, challenging thinking, right? Like, hey, I'm going to ask you a thing, but I need you to poke holes in it, ask me further up questions, or ask me to go bring you other information before we either generate a line of code or generate a decision to it. And so it's a very good thought process to think about technology you're not familiar with, industries you don't know anything about but are trying to bring cutting edge tech to, and formulate an opinion very quickly on it. Again, the sort of speed of ideas and releases with this, not just the capabilities with GPT, but what you can do with it, I think is going to really accelerate a lot of that. How do we bring these legacy antiquated industries further further closer to parity sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that, you know, one of the things that we just released is the AI North Star playbook.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a
it's very pretty.
Thank you. It's a high level guide essentially to help you decide, you know, for mid market companies who are looking to get started with AI and are not quite sure how. It's a very high level guide of how to figure out what problem to solve, mm-hmm. sort of where to start. And then how to build out a solution that will allow them to not only get started with AI to reduce their operational costs, you know, so they execute more efficiently, but it also lays the foundation for them to be innovative so they can catapult in the future while also reducing costs. So it's got some technical stuff in there. It's got some design thinking in there. And I'll put a link to it in the show notes here.
I've read through it because I'm a big fan of you and Drew's. And so those two together, I'm going to read whatever you guys put out. But what I like about starting with your North Star is a lot of the conversations where people are looking to be like, hey, can you come help me? It always starts with some version of, can AI solve this for me? And my response is always like, well, what do you want it to solve? Like, it's not, you know, it's not a magic wand. I wish it was. You have to deploy it very strategically. And going back to that sort of Shun's sort of framework, you need to spend a lot of time in the ideation definition before you even touch AI. And so the questions and kind of framework you give people are, look, it's almost like a process improvement problem you have to start with. Like, what are the things going on? And especially as I come into a lot of sort of legacy businesses that have been operating the same way for 30 years, you sort of have to ask, okay, how do you guys do all this? And, you know, capturing that information and then say, okay, well, there's one place we can use LLMs here, or maybe it's even something more simpler where you're getting so much consumer information, you just need to summarize it and then put it into a data store. Or then it becomes like, okay, how do I explain to a company that doesn't have databases what a database is? And so there's a lot of ways to deploy it, but I think a lot of people get hung up in the, oh, they'll just solve everything. Well, no, you really have to go through a process to decide what, how, and then be very choosy in how to deploy it.
Agreed, 100%. We talk about that. Like, pick a small problem that already exists, or a process that already exists in your business today, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, figure out, can we make it better? Can AI apply here? Can it help, right? Don't, you know, we call it boiling the ocean or eating the elephant, right? Don't try to solve too much at one time because, you know, it's not a silver bullet. You know, just like when, you know, the first pieces of SaaS software came out, they weren't silver bullets. They were enablers for your business. Yeah. And so such as AI as well, it's an enabler. One of the things I always say is it's an ingredient in the recipe that your business produces to provide value to your customers, whether service or products. That's the way to think of it. So
what I like about you made the SaaS comment, which can open up a whole other thing if we want to go down it. But, you know, SaaS, there's all these sort of conversations around enterprise SaaS at the moment, right? Which is, hey, do you need it? Have we just kind of commoditized every bit of what functionality is, that there's just too many SaaS platforms? I'm sure you follow Hacker News or any of the sort of aggregate sites that are, you know, so-and-so is getting rid of all their Salesforce or so-and-so is getting rid of all their SaaS. And I think it's the right intuition. I'm not recommending anyone deletes anything at the moment. But what I like about LLMs is kind of the promise of what SaaS software is. You can bring it in to customize it exactly for you. And so what the sort of puts in the power of non-technical companies is, I think a lot of people try to wedge their problems into what SaaS is out there. You should be taking the SaaS or the technology and customizing it to your problems. And so normally what you have to do is like hire a consultant or a third-party developer to come in, and there's this whole kind of process, but you can accelerate that with the kind of cleaner model of defining what you want, looking for areas of improvement, and then using that LLM to help steer, how do I make what I have available to me at the moment more effective to my need? Instead of, you know, I think it kind of goes back to the curiosity people don't have as much, which is the software was built for me. It's not doing what I want. There's either a feature, a setting, or there's someone I need to talk to get it done. And if I can't do that, great. There's probably an API, and, you know, the ability to tell Claude or Gemini or ChatGPT, give me a quick Python script to hit the API to get this data down to write whatever. I think a lot more people should feel empowered to do that and should be experimenting a lot more with the, what can I do with my existing things? How can even the ChatGPT UI help me without even deploying something technical, just to make stuff conform to my needs?
100%.
So experimenting a lot more.
You start with the UI, right? Every piece of AI that I even begin to think about building, I start by just typing it into the ChatGPT AI, right? Or the Claude. So we talked a little bit about like the ingredients and the pieces of building software, but now I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about building scalable software that delivers real impact. And from your experience at RV and some of these other companies and your current client base, tell me a little bit about how you've approached that, some of the problems you've overcome.
Yeah, you know, scalable is a fun term when you're designing software up front, and because it means a lot to whoever's, and differently to a lot who's in the room. And so from an engineering standpoint, it's like, oh great, you know, how can I handle 200 requests a second or something like that? From a business standpoint, it's like, okay, will, you know, thousands of users be able to use this, or how do I generate more revenue with it? And I think as you're either coming as a consultant or product, or just trying to help people in general, you should be thinking about, what does scale mean to us? And then what are those more important metrics we're trying to do? You know, building world-class products is like a fine moniker, but really at the end of the day, it's like, we're trying to build world-class products and make money off of it at the same time. Like, those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. And you kind of have to think about, what is the business side of things? And so you're trying to sort of encapsulate all these sort of ideas to say, okay, there's experience, there's sort of technology that's going to meet the demands, whether that's a technical stand or a consumer stand, and then is it supporting the business? You know, I got to do a lot of like fun self projects over the past couple months that just are silly things I've wanted to do, which is one of the things I do is I take a lot of screenshots of the products I'm looking at. And so I think I did a script where I have, I think, over 10,000 screenshots over the past 6 or 7 years, just, you know, sitting around. I can never find them. I can never use them. And so I just did a quick sort of ChatGPT script that would send it off to Vision, come back with a description of it, and then rename it so I can go back and find it later. Like, that's fun. It scales for my case, but it's not necessarily a business. And so I think that's when you have to kind of come into, we're never going to train our own model. We're never going to do our own stuff. Where can I deploy maybe those endpoints to help scale reading invoices or responding to customer requests? It's really hard to get to the definition, but when you do, it sets up for the how I'm building that scalable solution to solve whatever the fill in the blank is.
Yeah, 100%. So you've you know, left corporate America and started your own fractional CTO business. And I know, you know, for people like you and I who are just driven, like you said earlier, life's too short to build, you know, shitty software or bad customer experiences.
You're going to have to put explicit on this podcast now, I think. So
that's all right. But, you know, you've built software. You've broken out on your own now. For people who are driven, you want to, we're not perfectionists necessarily, but we care deeply about the end result, the product that we produce. So I'm curious, you know, and there's a host of engineers and engineering leaders who are dealing with this in their organizations. How do you balance, you know, technical delivery and technical leadership with freedom?
I will candidly say I'm struggling with it at the moment. What do they say is like constraints the best, you know, driver of innovation or creativity? And when you suddenly have a lack of daily constraint of I have to be in one-on-ones and meetings and all that, it's a very weird time to structure that sort of overall schedule. You and I were chatting a little bit about, we both kind of get up early because we have kids and families and we have to find that other time. I have been struggling with the compartmentalizing work and then shifting from the, if you're doing strategy and execution at the same time, you know, one person shop, how do you move between those modes? And, you know, I actually had a bunch of note cards I've been doing tasks on to be able to kind of focus on, okay, I'm only going to think on the one thing. I can't think about the larger project because I've already defined this bit of scope I have to do and I just need to go do it. And so it's been really hard to get into a cadence of, you know, how am I doing the freedom stuff I want to do, like work out and spend time with family? How am I hanging out with people or drumming up business or just keeping partners up to date? And then I have to go do it. You know, I've been blessed over the past, like every job I've had to work with really good engineers who I can have a really good conversation with. And they will just go off and magically do stuff and come back. I don't have them right now, which is really hard to be like, oh no, I have to go do that, which is kind of what I wanted to do, but also really hard at the same time. So I'm candidly still figuring it out. I think the sort of piece of advice I have, and this is how you and I got connected through various people, everyone goes through these problems. You know, it's kind of like if you ever go to professional therapy, you suddenly realize you aren't the only one with those problems. Finding a lot of people just to group therapy with and kind of get, oh, everyone's done this before. It's not a problem unique to me. And there's a lot of people who've gone through this who are super successful and they'll figure it out. So I see a lot of hope in it. I'm kind of maybe two in the woods at the moment to have a good answer on it. But there's all sorts of funny jokes when you set off to do your own thing. That's like, know, starting your own company is fun because you sleep like a baby, you know, wait for the beat. And it's like, you wake up every 2 hours crying, or why quit your 40-hour a week job to suddenly work 120 hours, you know, as little stuff too. So it's been eye-opening, and I think every truism's out there too, but it's really rewarding. And I think this is maybe where you and I can kind of align on it is, it's all you at that point, and it's all the risk of yours, all the problems are yours, all the tasks are yours, but you know, solving those problems is what's fun. And you're not just solving technical problems, you're solving now the how do I want to work? What's the life look like? All those other things that maybe weren't necessarily what you thought were going to be a consulting company, but the things you have to solve as well too.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm in the same boat. It's difficult, right? It's not only is it difficult, it's scary to take that step. My 6-year-old went to the dentist, or no, went to the doctor yesterday because he had to get staples removed, and he was scared. And I said, "Buddy, I know, you know, scary, you know, but do it anyway because you have to. We have to do it." And after I commended him, I said, "You know, I know you were scared, but you did it anyway, and that's the definition of bravery, and I'm proud of you." And so it's okay to do the scary thing, whether you're looking for the new job or you're introducing AI or a new concept, a new process within an organization. It's scary, but that's leadership and that's bravery. And so I haven't found the solution to balancing delivery and business development and being a great dad and working out and staying healthy and eating healthy. I take it day by day, you know? Some days I wake up and make a cup of coffee and go for a run, and other days I sleep for another 30 minutes. And then, but it's, you know, it's just one foot in front of the other, I think is the best approach that I found, at least. Someone, if you know better, send me a message. I'd be
Yeah,
open.
please CC me on it too. We should come up with that. That's how we should test new model versions. Like, hey, here's our life problem. How do I solve all this and see what they come out with? We should try it with a new Gemini 2.0 and see if it can give us answers, and then we'll know AGI is here.
I know. Well, Chris, thanks for coming. I'm glad to have you. It was a great conversation. Let everyone know, you know, the name of your company and where they can reach you.
Yeah, currently working through that right now. Branding your own company is a fun adventure for anyone who's gone through that. The name is Verdian Solutions. This was a ChatGPT prompt of, I think I went through something of like, hey, help me come up with something fun and futuristic. And it was Viridian, which is from a show, Better Off Ted. And so I like the idea of verde, you know, mixing two colors. And the hypothesis being, like we were talking about, bringing cutting edge tech to existing businesses to solve unique problems is how you create a better outcome for everyone involved too. So, you know, you take two colors and create a new one. So Verdian Solutions, I'm still early stages of just figuring out what that means, but if you want to talk about anything or even just talk about AI in general, I probably have just as many questions as you do. But it's fun to go kind of solve this and what I'm excited about for the next couple of years.
Awesome. Thanks for coming, man.
Thank you.